today our topic is charitable remainder trust and other kinds of trust. However, I don't think we're through with some of the basic information about taxes. For instance, many people are concerned about selling their residence and maybe starting to rent a smaller apartment or some other way of living than in the home. Now, you undoubtedly have read in the newspapers that they have raised the exempt portion of the sale of a residence for senior citizens, people 65 or older, and that's raised up to $35,000. That means that if you sell your house for $35,000, there will be no capital gains tax. But what if you sell your house for more than $35,000? Then there will be an adjusted capital gains tax. And that capital gains tax is figured by a formula. I put that formula on the board as I remembered it, and I'm sure it's quite right. Say, for instance, that the person in mind had bought a house for $30,000 and he sold it after he was 65 for $50,000, he would have a gross capital gain of $20,000. However, he will not have to pay capital gains tax on $20,000, but only on a portion of it. So the formula is capital gain over 1 minus $35,000 over the sale price times $20,000 over 1 equals the adjusted capital gain. So we started with $20,000, and when we multiply that out, $35,000 over $50,000 times $20,000, we get $14,000. In other words, this is this. And so the $20,000 capital gains minus $14,000 equals your adjusted capital gains. So a senior citizen would pay, figure his capital gains tax on this capital gain, not on the gross $20,000 capital gains. Now, if a person sells a house and then buys another residence, of course, of equal value, there is no capital gain either. But this is, and then up above, I've written down J.K. Lasser's 1977 income tax report, or manual. I forget whether it's report or manual. But every year, J.K. Lasser publishes an income tax book. And it's several hundred pages long. It's well indexed, and it has such categories as listing of taxable income, listing of non-taxable income. It has also an index at the back. Any subject you might be thinking of that would relate to taxes, it's there in that index and shows you back where to find it. Even if you do not fill out your own income tax report, this book is something you should get every year just in order to know what kind of information to furnish the person or the business that does your income tax reporting for you. The price changes from year to year. I believe the last one I bought was $1.95 about 3 years ago. Perhaps it's something like $2.95 or $3.50 by now. But it is, I think, the most complete and practical reference for anyone making out income tax. It has formulas such as that in the book. It gives examples of calculation. And just apart from this capital gain, there are various ways to figure capital gain depending on what income tax bracket you're in. It's all illustrated in this book. So if you've not felt you've been in the know, this would give you a good start on knowing what's happening and furnishing the kind of information that your tax expert needs in order to do the job. Because it's up to you to furnish the information. And he works with the information you give him, so he's limited by the information you give him, and if you don't know what's valuable, you won't give him the right information. Okay, I wanted to share that with you. I think we talked yesterday about the other formula that has to do with valuation or appraisal of land as of January 1st, 1977, that there doesn't have to be an actual appraisal made, but that by formula you go back to, you establish that by a formula involving the year of purchase, then that point in time, January 1st, 1977, the point of sale, and these factors all together are used then to establish what the price was on January 1st, 1977, which is a new valuation date. And then thereafter, the cost basis of inherited property, you know, that goes after 1977, you will simply inherit the cost basis of the person who is leaving this bequest or device to you. Are there any questions about that? Now, I would like to illustrate one more example of federal unified taxes and state taxes before we get into trust, so you see how these can be valuable to you. Have you all got this? I'm going to erase that. Maybe I shouldn't try to write this down. Just share it with you so you get the concept. If you want to take notes as I'm talking, it would be just fine. We are talking about an estate consisting of 400 acres of land, $400,000, machinery $100,000, insurance $26,000, life insurance, stocks $27,000, bank accounts $20,000, a gross estate of $573,000. And indebtedness $30,000, last illness $3,000, probate cost $40,000, $73,000 of shrinkage. So the net taxable estate is $500,000. This husband and wife do not have children. They have nephews. So what are they going to do about it? Well, the will of the husband conveys everything to his wife. And the wife's will conveys everything to nephews. And that works both ways. The wife's will reads like a mirror image of that. So at the death of the husband, there's a marital deduction of $250,000, like we said, or 50% of the estate, whichever is greater. In this case, it's the same, because 50% of $500,000 is $250,000. So there's no tax on that $250,000. What about the other $250,000? Yes, there is a federal tax of $70,800, and there's unified credit of $47,000, assuming that this death takes place in 1981. So the actual federal tax at the death of the husband will be $23,800. The Minnesota taxes on this whole estate, some on the spouse, because exemptions are only $105,000, the rest on the nephews, is $18,425. So we have a total tax at the death of the husband of $42,225. Let's write that down. $42,000. We'll just round off these figures. Death one. Okay, now we go down to death two. Death of wife. There will be $155,800 minus $47,000 credit. And so death two, we'd have a federal tax of $108,000. And we have a Minnesota tax going to nephews. The tax would be more than if it went to sons. But the Minnesota tax to the nephews would be $32,760. So we have a total of $141,560. Now that's quite a bit of tax. We're getting into what? $183,000. This is figured on the basis of Minnesota and federal taxes. So this is a case where a husband says everything to wife, and then the wife says everything to nephews. And this is the total tax bill. What if they had a different plan? Now, I'm not saying that this is a plan that you should do, but it's just something that you should know what happens under a different plan. Well, the first part is very similar. In the American deduction, there's no tax. Because half of it going to wife, half to spouse, and half to unit trust. What's the difference in the tax? Well, let's first of all understand what we mean by unit trust. Half the unit trust would be $250,000 would go to a charitable remainder trust to provide income at 6% for the remaining spouse for all the days of her life. At the end of that time, then this $250,000 in the trust fund would go to the charity with whom the contract was made, like Lutheran Church in America, or American Lutheran Church, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, or with any other nonprofit corporation acting as a trustee and the beneficiary of that kind of agreement. Well, on the $250,000, no tax. Now, on the other $250,000, there is a life value, and that would be taxed. And we would end up then with a total federal tax of $8,362. And at at the death of the wife, the $250,000 in that trust would not be taxed at all. But the $250,000 going to the nephews would be taxed. And we therefore have, at the death of the remaining spouse, we would have a tax. And that tax would be a federal tax of $23,800 and a Minnesota tax of $17,840. That would be a total of $50,002. How does that compare with $183,000?
But you say that's on a $500,000
estate. Yes.
And the other one was on $250,000.
No, this was also a $500,000 estate. $500,000 estate here, and at the death of the husband, see, the husband's first to die, the taxes would be $42,000 because half of it is a marital deduction, the other half is taxed. So that death of husband, the total tax of state and federal would be only $42,000. But then now the wife owns everything, and she gives everything to her nephews. Then the federal tax would be $108,000, and the state tax would be $32,000 for a total of $141,560. It means that the total tax under Plan 1, so we have two different plans here, Plan 1 and Plan 2. Under Plan 2, husband and wife had talked it over. They decided, well, we'll give half of our estate to the nephews at the death of the second spouse to die. And at the death of the first spouse to die, we'll create a charitable remainder trust with half of our estate. So the husband dies. Half of the estate goes directly to her as her own property. The other half of the estate is given to the charitable organization to establish a unit trust, which would provide a 6% income per annum to the remaining spouse all the days of her life. Then, at her death, the half that she has ownership over, she disperses by will to her nephews. And because she is giving something to nephews, there is a state tax and there is a federal tax. But all of that tax which she gives to her nephews totals only $50,000. And the other $250,000 in which she's been getting income all her life, she has no ownership in, never did have. She had only an income interest. The ownership lies in the church where the husband placed it.
earlier. And so the total tax for the whole estate, first death and second death, is only $50,000, as compared with the state and federal tax, death one plus death two, without any kind of trust, it would be $183,000. So there's a tax difference there of $123,000. That means that the Christian who decided to do this was able to give $250,000 to the church, which only really didn't cost $250,000 to the donor. It cost more like $120,000. I just wanted to illustrate that principle before we get into the consideration of the particulars of charitable remainder trust.
I thought that when you gave to a church or that there wouldn't be any tax.
They were,
that was
tax free. Well, I guess what we're saying here is exactly the same thing, because this, you're not giving all of it. This has never been given to the church. This is given to the nephews.
I mean,
right?
$8,362.
Yeah, okay. There's a charitable value. I mean, there's a charitable value, and then there's a life value to the person who is receiving. The woman, his spouse, is receiving income for maybe 20, 25 years. And according to the laws of the land, we have to figure what that value is on using actuarial tables and using the rate of return. And so we are by legally bound to figure out what the life value is of that contract. And that portion of it, then, is a taxable event. It's very little, you see, but there is a little bit. If that person were old enough, and the charitable remainder value would be large enough, then the remaining the income value to the donor's spouse would be so little that it might fall under the exemptions. But since this person has some other values besides that value, therefore, there is a little tax. It's greatly reduced. As you can see, a difference of $133,000 difference in taxes. Now, is that any good for anybody? It's not good for anybody who doesn't intend to give anything by deferred contract to the church. If a person isn't interested in doing that and has decided not to do it, it certainly won't help him a bit. But if a person has already decided in his own mind and heart, or husband and wife have decided, that along the line they would make a contribution to the church by will, then they might do it this way, a way which would guarantee income to the remaining spouse. The other way, if at the death of the first there was a $250,000 given directly to the church, that would create a no tax situation, absolutely no tax whatever, because in that case $250,000 given outright to the church would be an untaxable event. $250,000 which the wife would retain would be covered by the marital deduction of 50% of the adjusted gross estate, so in that case it'd be no tax event. But then the remaining spouse would have income only from $250,000 to which she had incidence of ownership. And this way, she would have income from the total estate of $500,000 as long as she lives. So that's the difference. You are right in your assumptions, absolutely.
Where do they invest these unit trusts so that that money is protected?
Where do we invest that? That is invested by the trustees, in our case, of the American Lutheran Church. And there is an investment committee, I think composed of five people from the board of directors, and several of them are professional investment people. And then there is a man who is well qualified in investments and came from the commercial world to be the investment officer for the board of trustees. And he then is the investment officer for all of the funds of the American Lutheran Church. His name isn't Olson or Schweitzer. He has an odd name for a Lutheran. His name is Kelly.
We had that same thing with Mr. O'Kelly.
He did. Well, anyhow, the record is terrific. And a recent report came out that the investments and the earnings on investments of the American Lutheran Church retirement fund, pension fund, has the best growth record of any major fund in the last year. So there has been never any defaulting on any kind of contract, whatever. Besides, the protection for the donor is, in order to reach the contract, of course, we try to do it out of earnings and due, so that the principal remains there to do the Lord's work. But should it fail to do so, what would we do? We'd have to invade the principal to pay out the contract to the donor, so that the church, if there's any hard times or any bad situation economically in the country, the donor would not be the loser, the church would be the loser, because we would use up the assets of that trust fund to fulfill the contract to the donor. So who's taking the risk? The church is taking the risk. The church is doing all this, the work. You know, it may be a matter of 20 or 25 years where investment responsibilities are there, reports to the government, checks to the donor, income tax information supplied to the donor, all these years, you see, without any charge to the donor. So that sounds like an awfully big sales pitch. I didn't mean to get into sales pitches here. Okay, that's what we mean when we say there is a difference in estate planning, which involves either direct charitable distribution of a portion of the estate or indirect or deferred giving through a contract, in which the distribution is made at a later date. Now, these red booklets, were they passed out yesterday? If not, please pass them out now.
Here, put half of them that way and put them half of them this way.
Our subject today is trusts, and just again to illustrate what a trust is, very briefly, a trust could be described as follows. Mr. A gives $1,000 to Mr. B so that Mr. B can take care of this $1,000 and give the interest to C. So you have a donor or grantor, the one who gave the $1,000, and then you have a trustee, the one who has it in hand and manages it, and then you have a beneficiary who receives the income from it but does not manage it. So that's really the basics of a trust. The trustee may be told by the trustor to do something else besides income. May tell him to give income for 20 years, at which time you give the principal or the capital of the trust, the corpus of the trust, to that beneficiary. So when you're talking about a trust, it's a very flexible arrangement whereby the trustor or grantor can say exactly what's to happen and under what conditions and when it should happen. So when we think of trust, we're thinking of something very broad, very flexible. The trustee can be your brother. The trustee can be your nephew. The trustee can be your church. The trustee can be your bank. So it could be a corporation. It can be an individual. So we're talking about something very, very flexible and very, very useful. Some widows choose this route of creating a trust, or husbands talk it over and create a trust for their wives while they're still alive, so that when they die, the management goes on, because a trustee is already in charge, and he's going to be operating it in the future as he operated it in the lifetime of the husband,
for the benefit of the wife. And all these things are taken care of in advance. There's no particular tax advantage in that. In fact, it costs something to have this kind of management, but it may be worth it. The bank trust banks charges on large trusts, like say $200,000 or so, they would charge a fee of around 0.6% of the corpus of the trust per annum. So that would be like $600 on a $100,000 trust. That's not too bad. If the trusts are smaller, for amounts like $50,000 or $30,000, then their fees are proportionately much higher, like maybe several percent per annum. And then you'd have to think twice whether you'd want to do it that way. Now, there are trusts which are revocable. That means you could call them back. Voke, that part of the word means to call. Revoke, to call back. In that case, it just simply means that any time that you want to quit this trust arrangement, you just terminate it. You say, this is it. I'm through. We cease to have this trust. Give me back the principal. Give me back the corpus of the trust. Okay, then that's a revocable trust. And then there are other kinds of trusts which are irrevocable. And that is, when you enter them, you sign an agreement that you will never, never, never change this trust. And that becomes then an irrevocable trust. If you are naming someone as a beneficiary of income and of the corpus of the trust, then you have made a gift to somebody, in which case you are then responsible for the same kind of tax reporting in general. There's some variations, as if you had made a gift to a person. And tax-wise, that whatever taxes would be involved, it would be a present tax, because you irrevocably gave up possession of something in favor of someone else's possession. So that would be a present tax consequence. But if you had a revocable trust in lifetime, then you have not transferred anything at all. And therefore, you are not subject to a gift tax at that time. But if it becomes irrevocably transferred to somebody at your death, then it would be figured as part of the estate, which is passing from you to somebody else, and then would be treated tax-wise as if it would have been in your general estate and at that time was divided up. Now, some people have the idea by creating trusts they can avoid the present gift tax and they can avoid the future estate tax. Not so. If it happens that way, that you're avoiding a present transfer tax and you're avoiding a future transfer tax, it means that it is not kosher. Because somewhere along the line, it is a transfer. Future transfers are not presently taxed, but present transfers are. Future transfers are taxed at the time of when the official transfer is made. Similarly, some people have the idea that if they form a joint account in a bank, that this way they will avoid a transfer tax, whether that's a unified tax under the new law, or whether it's a present gift tax, which is a part of the unified tax. Really, there is no way that you avoid, and there's no way that you'd want to avoid being a responsible citizen living up to the laws of the state and of the federal tax system. Even though we don't like it, often we hardly have the right to act independently apart from the laws of the land. According to Romans chapter 12, even the governments that are not especially tasty to us, but if they're our governments, they are God's way of keeping law and order. So I don't know why I say this to a group of Christians, except that I always say it, whether a group of Christians or not, because it's just part of the system. It's part of the total context. I heard an illustration of the trust which appeals to me, and it makes it easy to remember. And that is, assume that my wife has a brother. Assume it's his birthday coming up. Assume that this brother is a kind of a shifty character. Some days you could love him to death. Another day you're just sorry you have a brother like that. And so she woke up nice and cheerful that morning. Not too generous, but she gave me $10. Here, buy something for my brother Bob for his birthday. She's the grantor. I'm the trustee. And brother Bob is the beneficiary. Okay. She calls me up on the phone at the store. I just got a letter from Bob. He's done something terrible. Don't buy that gift for him. She revoked the trust. That's a revocable trust. And so it never comes off because she revoked it. Now what if she had said before I left in the morning, now you know how shifty my emotions are. And if I call you at the office today and tell you anything else than what I told you this morning, don't you listen to me. You do what I asked you to do this morning. Buy that gift for Brother Bob. And so, sure enough, she calls me at 11:45. Now she said, don't buy that gift on your lunch break today. Because Bob has pulled another big boner and I'm not going to give him a birthday present. I said, aha, I can't listen to you. You told me this morning, regardless of whatever you said on the phone, I should not listen to it. Okay. And so I don't listen to it. And I carry out the contract. That was an irrevocable trust agreement. Oral as it was irrevocable because she told me it was irrevocable and I would not listen to her call. Does that help you to understand the difference between irrevocable and irrevocable trust? Yes.
But that's verbal. That's a verbal trust.
Yes.
How about, shouldn't it be written?
Yes, it should be written. I only said that just to illustrate the principle.
Yeah.
Right. Now, trusts are written. Right. I suppose there could be an oral trust. If it were witnessed somewhere along the line, it might stand up in court. But that isn't the way trusts are. Trusts are written. Correct. All right. Any question? Okay, then. Here's a question.
In the trust, I understand one of the advantages of a trust is, especially where the person dies, and that you do, say, probate charges. Say, like your bank is your trust fund.
Yes.
Or the hammer. And that, is there enough, say, thinking in terms of $100,000.
Yes.
Is there enough, are probate charges high enough to take care of that, or is it advisable?
I'm going to repeat what you said because we want it on the tape for people who are getting these tapes. The comment and question involved the matter of establishing a trust in order to avoid the inconvenience and the cost of the probate process. Is that valid? Yes, it is. It is a good way to go. It's a good way to make distribution. And it does avoid probate costs. Whatever is outside of that trust will still have to be probated. But that part will go straight on through and be distributed according to the terms of the trust. There are two ways that you can use a trust in connection with a will. One is to have the trust operating in your lifetime and then make reference to it in your will without incorporating it in your will. The other is that you incorporate the trust into your will as part and parcel of the will, incorporating old trusts with a new trust that you may be creating in your will. And so there are various ways to go. And another thing that Christians should remember that don't want to go into charitable remainder trust because they don't want to or cannot really afford to give up possession of their property by entering into a unit trust with or an annuity trust with their church, they can simply say in their other management trust with the bank, when I die, make the following distribution to Bethany Lutheran Church of Lakeville, Minnesota, and to Luther Seminary in St. Paul.
And then the trustee of that trust, which is not a charitable trust, but just a management trust which you had in your life, that distribution will be made. And in your taxes for your estate, it will be exempt from taxes because it's a charitable distribution. Does that help answer your question? I'm sure some of you think maybe it more than answers, or I talk too long. Another question here.
Now, what you just said, that would apply to the smaller estates, I imagine. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's valid for large estates or small estates. Yeah.
How small do people give to the church, or to establish a unit trust?
Okay, we have floors, $50,000 for unit trust or annuity trust. Those are the elite trust, $50,000 or more. It can be funded with cash. It can be funded with real estate. If it's funded with real estate and there's capital gain on that real estate, the capital gains tax is completely avoided because the donor, if such a gift is made in lifetime or the other way, the donor is not selling anything. The donor is giving a house. The donor is giving a piece of land. He's not selling it. So in the eyes of the government, there has been no sale. There has been no capital gain. He has simply given it to the charity in by will or in lifetime to form a trust. The charitable organization which receives it is exempt from capital gains tax when it sells this property to invest in something a little more manageable, like bonds and stocks and etc. So there is that tax advantage that if you sold a property to get some cash to enter into a trust agreement with the church, that would be wasteful. So you should not. Or even, say you have some stocks, you're too young, let's look at somebody older, who bought some stocks in 1933 when they weren't worth anything, but held on to them, and now has a stock which is about 90% capital gain. Such a person, if he wants to make a direct gift to his church, should not cash those stocks in and then give cash. Even if you're going right to your local congregation, give them a gift of the stocks. Go to a bank and get a stock power and execute that, and together with the stocks, deliver it to your home church. Or if you wanted to establish a trust with them, you would deliver them then to the American Lutheran Church. And if you do that by mail, then you always want to separate the stocks from the stock power. You do not transfer by, you know, endorsing the stock, but you send the stock separately, and then you also execute a stock power with the assistance of your bank. They'll have to do that, and you send that stock power separately. And that way the stock is protected. No one could, it's endorsed. Now somebody could grab it along the way, and where did it go? Okay, does that help answer your question?
$50,000 minimum for trust?
That's the floor. That's the minimum, right.
I thought you had some smaller.
Aha, we have, sure. But we're just talking about unit trust and annuity trust. Those are individual trust funds. Now, we have pooled funds. And that's a life income agreement. And it's something, it works something like this, like shares almost. We start these pooled funds with about $10 a unit. And you buy your gift is valued at so many units, see? But then the investment of these funds is together with other people, and there the floor on that is $1,000. So you can go any amount from there on up, and it's always adjusted to the value of the share, so that if the share was started at $10, it's worth $11.33. It would be a total number of shares, and if you sent in $2,765 and it was $4.62 more than an even number of shares, we'd have to send you a check for $4.73, or we'd have to write you a letter, hey, send us another $6.19, and then you have a full another share. It sounds crazy to write these. We're always embarrassed to write these letters. But somebody sends in a sum of money to
take part in the pooled income fund. He says, say, send 99 cents more.
And what are the probate charges?
Probate charges vary. There, some of the states now, Wisconsin, Minnesota, have an informal probate process. It's a new law in which a number of the court hearings are eliminated, so that there's simply a process of reporting information. And then that's reported to the clerk rather of the court rather than to the judge. And if it's done right, why then it's received. I think at the end of the line, the judges have to review and, you know, proclaim that this is valid and finished. But in that case, you see, you don't have to have legal counsel to represent you when you have a court hearing, because there aren't any. The executor still should have legal counsel, though. But it reduces the cost tremendously. Now you're talking about legal counsel. Maybe that's part of the cost, and that's usually a major part of the cost. Some states have formulas, and the attorneys have to charge no more than a certain rate, or they have a recommended rate for attorneys, like no more than 6% of estates under 50,000, no more than 3% of estates over 250. Well, it's variable, and some states recommendations. Some it's simply a kind of a tradition, where the attorneys of a state, their bar association, has standards which they follow. So I can't answer for all states. We can say this, that where the estate is small, then your costs are large percentage-wise. Like your costs may well be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12% in a small estate. Where there's a large estate, the administration costs may drop down to 3%. Because, you know, you're just dealing with bigger figures, but same kind of transactions, same kind of activities have to go on. So that's about as uninformative as I could be. Because it is variable, and it would be crazy for me to say, you know, this is what it would be. But we do, in estate planning, use a kind of a formula, a figure that we grab out of the dark, and that's 8%. But it's not realistic. But when you don't know what they're going to be, you have to figure something when we're doing projecting some plans. Okay? Any other questions?
Just a small question. With reference to your chalkboard there, that 6% that's going to go to the widow from the unit trust, you know, the income, is that taxable?
Yes, in a unit trust, it's common income, right.
Okay.
Now, we can talk about some other kind of agreements, but first, since we talked about unit trust, we're going to run out of time. Every day we run out of time. Let's just, it's here in this red description, and maybe we just should refer to that as we go along. Let's go to number three, a gift by annuity trust. Let's assume we're talking about lifetime trust, something created now by your husband while you and he are alive. For income in your retirement, when he dies, the income keeps coming to you until the Lord calls you home. An annuity trust, floor, $50,000. The law requires that the contract give at least 5% of the gift. Let's assume a $100,000 gift. Then the annuity, if it were a 5%er, would be $5,000 per year for the rest of your life, your husband's life and your life. For that kind of a contract could be funded with capital gains property. There would be no capital gains tax. When that trust was formed, we would figure what the charitable remainder value is as of that date. And if you are young, it's not all that big. If you're old, it's very big. But let us assume that $100,000 trust, you're around 70 years old, that there is a charitable remainder value of, say, $45,000. Well, if that's the charitable remainder value, that is your present income tax deduction. And we would fill out a report, a tax report for you, saying you have a $45,000 income tax deduction because of this contract. then you would be able to use that tax deduction in the year of the gift as much as you could use. And when you use capital gains property, it's limited to 30% of your adjusted gross income per annum, but you could carry over to next year, and the next year, and the next year, and the next year, and the following year, the year of the gift plus five. So for 6 years, you could have income tax relief. So that's the two tax benefits. One, no capital gains tax. Two, if you use capital gains property like stocks or real estate. Two, you would have that income tax deduction. But the income would be common taxable income. The annuity trust, the annuity is fixed at the time when the contract is entered in and never changes. Do we have depression? You still get your $5,000 a year. Do we have more earnings from this trust fund than 5%? It goes to the trust corpus. It does not go to you. Now, what about a unit trust? A unit trust is very similar to an annuity trust in establishing, you know, the capital gains, no capital gains tax. There is a present income tax deduction. All of that's the same. But there is a difference, and that is that you have a variable income instead of a fixed income. And the variable income is determined by the value of the trust on its valuation day, and that remains the same year after year. It's the same date each year. And a valuation of the trust funds are made. And say you start with $100,000 and you're receiving at 5%, but the earnings were 9%. What happens to that 4%? That's added to the value of the trust. And besides that, the securities which are being held are increased on the stock market or whatever is held. Then you say you had $4,000 gain in earnings undistributed, and you had another $6,000 in appreciation. You would then have $110,000. And you get 5% of that, which would be $5,500. So what are we getting at? We're getting at seeing which is best for your situation. If you are 85 years old, you would probably want to enter into an annuity trust at the highest percentage that you could get, say 7%. And you'd have your sure $7,000 every year. If you were young, like 55 or 60, then you would think in terms of a unit trust and take the lowest percentage allowable by law, which is 5%, and have some kind of sense of keeping up with inflation, because you would be getting more and more income as the years go along if the economy is bullish or if it's inflationary. What if it would go down? You would run the risk of getting less. But if the economy runs down and we have a depression, so what? If you can buy beefsteak for 49 cents instead of $1.49, you don't need that much. So generally we say that if you're at all young, like under 65, you should think maybe in terms of unit trust. If you're 50 years old, by all means think unit trust. If you're 80, you probably think annuity trust. Is that difference made clear? Okay, those are the unit trust and the annuity trust are individual trust funds, separately invested, separately accounted, and it must be $50,000 or more. Now, we have two other ways to go. And one I alluded to a little while ago, and that is the life income agreement. And in that case, you still have the same advantages. You can fund it with capital. You can fund it with capital gains tax, with capital gains property, and get that break. You get also an income tax deduction for its charitable remainder value. The distribution is what the fund earns, is what the donors get. And for the last 4 years, or pooled income fund has distributed 7.5% or more per annum. So it's been a pretty good yielder. We open new life income agreement funds. We have more than one as time goes on because it's advantageous to do so to the donor. I won't take time to say why it's advantageous, but it is, especially on the tax break, I mean the income tax deduction break. It's easier to figure for us and it's better for the donor. Now let's go to number two, gift annuity agreement.
And this is
for all of us. If you got $100 that you didn't spend at the end of the year, send it in. And you can have a gift annuity agreement and receive income. It's kind of ridiculous to have these little contracts, but we have them because we feel it's important for everybody to be able to participate if they want to. We don't have many little ones, but we have a few $200 gifts, and we actually paying out income on a $200 gift. It's a contract. It's an agreement. It's not a separate trust fund. But we treat it as though it were. In other words, we do not spend the principal. We invest these gifts and do not spend until the donor is called home by the Lord. So we're not taking any kind of risks. I understand that in times past there have been some institutions which accepted gifts like this and entered in gift annuity contracts and really didn't protect their investment. But that has not characterized the principal Lutheran bodies or Presbyterians or any of the mainline bodies of the church. They don't act irresponsibly like that. Okay. Do you want to hear what happens here? Well, for one thing, there's something that a gift annuity does not give you. That is, if you would fund a gift annuity with a house worth $60,000 and you had capital gains on that of $30,000, you would not be out from under the capital gains tax, but you would get capital gains tax relief. How? Well, the capital gains, say you had $20,000 of capital gains on that house that you gave for a gift annuity, fund a gift annuity, you would not have to pay that $20,000 tax. I mean, you would not have to pay the tax on that $20,000 all in one year. It would be spread out over the years of your life expectancy, so that if you had a life expectancy of 20 years, and that's all by actuary tables, not any kind of way to fudge. There are tables that says how long you're supposed to live if you're so-and-so years old. So that would be like $1,000 of capital gain each year for the next 20 years. Now you know that if you have $1,000 of capital gains in 1 year and you're in retirement income, it may mean nothing, right? It may mean like nothing. So that really reduces it greatly. What are the advantages then? You get the advantage of a present income tax deduction for the value of your gift. Same thing, not the whole of it, but a percentage of it. Like the lady asked you before, why was there some tax here? Well, because there's a life value and there's a charitable remainder value. The charitable remainder value is non-taxable. It's a tax deduction. But the life value is. Now, there is a distinct advantage to a gift annuity, and that is a portion of the income that you get is non-taxable income. And it's variable. If you're young, your non-taxable portion is small. If you're old, the non-taxable portion is large. Do you want some examples? Okay, let's take somebody at the age of 50, young. The gift would generate an annuity of 5.2% per annum. The contribution, which is tax deductible, would be 29% of the gift. And 53.9% of the income would be non-taxable income, tax-exempt income. Okay, now let's step up to 75. Say you are a male and 75. then your gift, your annuity would be 7.7% of your gift. The income tax deduction would be 45.84%. And your non-taxable portion of your income would be 74.8%. So almost three-fourths of your income would be non-taxable. That's like adding a few percentages because you have that much more spendable income. We're going on. We're now to 85. Say an 85-year-old person giving $100,000, what would be his return? He would get $10,500 a year income. That'd be 10.5%. And he would get $57,760 of income tax deduction on a $100,000 gift. And of the income that he receives, 73% would be non-taxable. Shall we go all the way? Okay. Anybody who is 90 years old or older would get 12% annuity per annum each year, the rest of his life. And his tax deduction would be 66.18% of his gift would be an income tax deduction. And 70.5% of his income would be non-taxable income. I did a computation for a man in that bracket, and it ended up he'd have to get 21% on a commercial bond to have the same kind of spendable income. So the maximum is 12%. What's this for? This is for anybody who doesn't have a lot of money, has a lot of heart. It's for a school teacher who has a small pension and has Social Security and has $1,000 left at the end of the year, and she doesn't know what to do with it. She can send it in for a gift annuity and get some tax relief from it and get also a good income from it and have the satisfaction knowing that she is giving a gift which will assist in the Lord's work at some future date. Now, I put a sheet of paper out here, and I don't know if any of you want to write your birthday down and your name and your birthday, your address, and say, what would my gift annuity situation be? You have to put your birthday, not just the day, the month, the year. So we're all going to see how old you are. But if you're interested, just to have the information, no obligation, you write your name, your address, and your birthday, month, and year. And I'd be happy to send you. It doesn't take me too long to figure that out. So if anybody's interested, you can do that. Yes, the federal government does tax the church, and justly so, under certain conditions. And that is when the church is engaged in business which is not related to its non-profit function. For instance, if a church receives a farm as a gift and then went into the farming business and operated that farm, it would be generating income in an industry which is unrelated to its function. And therefore, it would be an unrelated business income. And the church would pay taxes. Right. And now the unrelated business income tax for charitable organizations went into effect January 1st of 1976, I believe. And there are so many interpretation exemptions that I would not want to, you know, just say off the top that everything that the church receives money for is taxed. It's not. But there are some very clear definitions there. And I think it's a just law. Why should the church be competing with other industries in a profit-making business and not have to pay tax? I think it's high time. Right. Mm-hmm. Unrelated business income of charitable organizations is income tax taxable.
Mm-hmm. church-related estate planning consultant. Yeah. What was
their
idea on it?
Well, my idea here is that when you are trying to make decisions, you need information. Now, the kind of information that I'm giving about charitable remainder trust is easily given by me, but not so easily given by, let's say, your bookkeeper, because he is not involved in that generally. He'd have to research it, look it up. So when you're counseling about a Christian's options for income, retirement income, I would naturally be able to tell you more detail about charitable remainder trust like we're doing this morning. On the other hand, that's not all of it. You would be wanting to consult with your CPA or your bookkeeper, your accountant, as regards some factors. You would also perhaps want to be consulting with your attorney, saying entering into this kind of a contract in lifetime, how would that affect my other disposition of property in my will, plan, and so on. And you might even want a conference, or you might want to go to your attorney in the presence of a person like myself in order to be able to have a three-way conversation so you surely understand what you're doing. That's what I'm saying. We find that if a person simply on the basis of what he hears from a person like me goes out and does something after the attorney says, hey, that was a dumb thing to do, you know. Because, you know, here you took your whole estate and put it into a charitable remainder trust, and you should have at least half of your estate at your disposal. And I would tell you that, too.